Night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. The following program contains frank language. If you feel you'll be offended by frank language, please tune away and rejoin WBAI in 2 hours.
She's just a girl and she's on fire. Hotter than a fantasy. Lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire. Filled with catastrophe. But she knows she can fly away.
Alicia Keys. It's one of my favorites. I'm Linda Perry, sitting in for the late Bob Fass on Radio Unnameable, a stake in the ground of alternative radio for more than 50 years. We'll be hearing from Palestinian-American activist Brooklyn's own Linda Sarsour in this program. It's her reaction to being targeted by right-wing forces which sought to discredit her and the Women's March. But first, let's set the table. This week, on Monday, the New York Times printed a front-page story about a disinformation campaign aimed at Linda Sarsour. She delivered a long-form response and talked from the heart about what she experienced on WBAI's morning show, What's Going On. She hosts What's Going On Wednesday mornings from 7 to 8 a.m. Tune in if you haven't heard Linda on What's Going On. Tune in and have a listen, or go to our archives, WBAI.org, and click on What's Going On Wednesday Mornings. The article that I mentioned is by Ellen Barry. It was published in the New York Times on the front page September 18th. 2022. It has a photo of women wearing pink pussy hats at the Women's March. I remember being there, and there was no room to move. It was so filled. There were so many women at this march, and we were herded into a very small space for so many people where there was no internet. It was the entire D.C. area was filled with women marching against Donald Trump. Here's the article. Ellen Barry is the author. How Russian Trolls Helped Keep the Women's March Out of Lockstep. Linda Sarsour awoke on January 23, 2017, logged onto the internet and felt sick. The weekend before, she had stood in Washington at the head of the Women's March, a mobilization against President Donald J. Trump that surpassed all expectations. Crowds had begun forming before dawn, and by the time she climbed up onto the stage, they extended farther than the eye could see. More than 4 million people around the United States had taken part, experts later estimated, placing it among the largest single-day protests in the nation's history. But then something shifted, seemingly overnight. What she saw on Twitter that Monday was a torrent of focused grievance that targeted her. In 15 years as an activist, largely advocating for the rights of Muslims, she had faced pushback, but this was a different magnitude. A question began to form in her mind. Do they really hate me that much? That morning, there were things going on that Ms. Sarsour could not imagine. More than 4,000 miles away, organizations linked to the Russian government had assigned teams to the Women's March at desks in bland offices in St. Petersburg. Using models derived from advertising and public relations, copywriters were testing out social media messages critical of the Women's March movement, adopting the personas of fictional Americans. They posted as black women critical of white feminism, conservative women who felt excluded, and men who mocked participants as hairy-legged whiners. But one message performed better with audiences than any other. It singled out an element of the Women's March that might at first have seemed like a detail. Among its four co-chairs was Ms. Sarsour, a Palestinian-American activist whose hijab marked her as an observant Muslim. And there's a photo of Linda Sarsour with the caption, "It's a leader of the initial Women's March in January 2017. Within days, Russian trolls were targeting her online. The photo shows her at the Women's March wearing her hijab. Over the 18 months that followed, Russian troll factories and its military intelligence service put a sustained effort into discrediting the movement by circulating damning, often fabricated narratives around Ms. Sarsour, whose activism made her a lightning rod for Mr. Trump's base and also for some of his most ardent opposition. 152 different Russian accounts produced material about her. Public archives of Twitter accounts known to be Russian contain 2,642 tweets about Ms. Sarsour, many of which found large audiences, according to an analysis by Advanced Democracy Incorporated. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts public interest research and investigations. Many people know the story about how the Women's March movement fractured, leaving lasting scars on the American left. A fragile coalition to begin with, it headed into crisis over its co-chair's association with Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam leader, who's widely condemned for his anti-Semitic statements. When this surfaced, progressive groups distanced themselves from Ms. Sarsour and her fellow March co-chairs, Carmen Perez, Tamika Mallory, and Bob Land, and some called for them to step down. But there's also a story that has not been told, one that only emerged years later in academic research of how Russia inserted itself into this moment. For more than a century, Russia and the Soviet Union sought to weaken their adversaries in the West by inflaming racial and ethnic tensions. In the 1960s, KGB officers based in the United States paid agents to paint swastikas on synagogues and desecrate Jewish cemeteries. They forged racist letters, supposedly from white supremacists, to African diplomats. They did not invent these social divisions. America already had them. Ladislav Bittman, who worked for the secret police in Czechoslovakia before defecting to the U.S., compared Soviet disinformation programs to an evil doctor who expertly diagnoses the patient's vulnerabilities and exploits them, prolongs his illness, and speeds him to an early grave instead of curing him. A decade ago, Russia's President Vladimir Putin oversaw a revival of these tactics, seeking to undermine democracies around the world from the shadows. Social media now provided an easy way to feed ideas into American discourse, something that for half a century the KGB had struggled to do. And the Russian government secretly funneled more than $300 million to political parties in more than two dozen countries in an effort to sway their policies in Moscow's favor since 2014, according to a U.S. intelligence review made public last week. What effect these intrusions had on American democracy is a question that will be with us for years. It may be unanswerable. Already, social media was amplifying Americans' political impulses, leaving behind a trail of damaged communities. Already, trust in institutions was declining and rage was flaring up in public life. These things would have been true without Russian interference. But to trace the Russian intrusions over the months that followed the first women's march is to witness a persistent effort to make all of them worse. And then there's a photo of the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg that's pictured here in the middle of the article. The caption is, after the 2016 election, the Russian disinformation operation at the Internet Research Agency shifted focus from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to broader U.S. targets. The next section in this article, and again, I am reading from the New York Times, How Russian Trolls Helped Keep the Women's March Out of Lockstep, by Ellen Barry, posted in the New York Times, published on the front page September 18th, 2022. And when I finish with this, we're going to go to Linda Sarsour's heartfelt response and thoughts at the time and thoughts now after this article came out. So going back now, refrigerators and nails. In early 2017, the trolling operation was in its imperial phase, swelling with confidence. Accounts at the Internet Research Agency, an organization based in St. Petersburg and controlled by a Putin ally, had boasted of propelling Mr. Trump to victory. That year, the group's budget nearly doubled, according to internal communication made public by U.S. prosecutors. More than a year would pass before social media platforms executed sweeping purges of Russian-backed sock puppet accounts. For the trolls, it was a golden hour. Under these auspicious conditions, their goal shifted from electoral politics to something more general, the goal of deepening rifts in American society, said Alex Eftimi, a former federal prosecutor who worked on a 2018 case against an administrator at Project Lakhta, which oversaw the Internet Research Agency and other Russian trolling operations. It wasn't exclusively about Trump and Clinton anymore, said Mr. Eftimi, now a partner at Morrison Forrester. It was deeper and more sinister and more diffuse in its focus on exploiting divisions within society on any number of levels. There was a routine. Arriving for a shift, workers would scan news outlets on the ideological fringes, far left and far right, mining for extreme content that they could publish and amplify on the platforms, feeding extreme views into mainstream conversations. Artyom Baranov, who worked at one of Project Lakhta's affiliates from 2018 to 2020, concluded that his coworkers were, for the most part, people who needed the money, indifferent to the themes they were asked to write on. If they were assigned to write text about refrigerators, they would write about refrigerators. Or say nails, they would write about nails, said Mr. Baranov, one of the handful of former trolls who have spoken on the record about their activities. But instead of refrigerators and nails, it was Putin, Putin, and then Putin. And then about Navalny, referring to Alexei Navalny, the jailed opposition leader. The job was not to put forward arguments, but to prompt a visceral emotional reaction, ideally one of indignation, said Mr. Baranov, a psychoanalyst by training who was assigned to write posts on Russian politics. The task is to make a kind of explosion to cause controversy, he said. When a post succeeded at enraging a reader, he said a coworker would sometimes remark with satisfaction, Liberala, Razavola, a liberal was torn apart. It wasn't on the level of discussing facts or giving new arguments, he said. It's always a way of digging into dirty laundry. Feminism was an obvious target because it was viewed as Western agenda and hostile to the traditional values that Russia represented, said Mr. Baranov, who spoke about his works in hope of warning the public to be more skeptical of material online. Already for months, Russian accounts purporting to belong to black women had been drilling down on racial rifts within American feminism. White feminism seems to be the most stupid 2K16 trend. Watch Muhammad Ali shut down a white feminist criticizing his arrogance. Ain't got time for your white feminist bullshit. Why black feminists don't owe Hillary Clinton their support. A little louder for the white feminists in the back. In January 2017, as the Women's March drew nearer, they tested different approaches on different audiences as they had during the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. They posed as resentful trans women, poor women, and anti-abortion women. They dismissed the marchers as pawns of the Jewish billionaire George Soros. And they derided the women who planned to participate, often in crudely sexual terms. In coordination, beginning on January 19th, 46 Russian accounts pumped out 459 original suggestions for hashtag Rename Million Women March, a hashtag created by a right-wing podcaster from Indiana. The hashtags read, the Why Doesn't Anybody Love Me March, the Strong Women Constantly Playing the Victim March, the Lonely Cat Lady March, the Cramp Camp, the Bearded Women Convention, Broken Broads Bloviating. Jeez. The Liberal Trail of Tears. Coyote Ugly Bitch Fest. In the meantime, another far more effective line of messaging was developing. And now there's another photo, a beautiful photo of Linda Sarsour near her desk, red hijab. The caption reads, Ms. Sarsour recalling the overwhelming torrent of attacks. She says, I mean, just imagine every day you woke up, you were a monster. Continuing on, it was like an avalanche is the heading for the next section. As one of the four co-chairs of the Women's March, Ms. Sarsour came with a track record and with baggage. The daughter of a Palestinian-American shopkeeper in Crown Heights, she had risen to prominence as a voice for the rights of Muslims after 9/11. In 2015, when she was 35, a New York Times profile anointed her a Brooklyn homegirl in a hijab as something rare, a potential Arab-American candidate for elected office. In 2016, Senator Bernie Sanders featured her at a campaign event, a stamp of approval from one of the country's most influential progressives, that troubled pro-Israel politicians in New York who pointed to her support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which seeks to secure Palestinian rights by isolating Israel. Critics of the movement contend that it threatens Israel's existence. Rory Landsman, then a city council member from Queens, recalls his growing alarm as she began to appear regularly at events for left-wing causes unrelated to Israel, like fair wages, where he felt her real agenda was trying to marry an anti-Israel agenda with different progressive causes. The news that Ms. Sarsour was among the leaders of the Women's March, said Mr. Landsman, a Democrat, struck him as heartbreaking, that's the word, that anti-Semitism is tolerated and rationalized in progressive spaces. That was politics as usual, and Ms. Sarsour was accustomed to it, the long-running feud among Democrats over the implications of criticizing Israel. But 48 hours after the march, a shift of tone occurred online, with a surge of posts describing Ms. Sarsour as a radical jihadi who had infiltrated American feminism. Ms. Sarsour recalls this vividly because she woke to a worried text message from a friend and glanced at Twitter to find that she was trending. Not all of this backlash was organic. That week, Russian amplifier accounts began circulating posts that focused on Ms. Sarsour, many of them inflammatory and based on falsehoods, claiming she was a radical Islamist, a pro-ISIS, anti-USA, Jew-hating Muslim who was seen flashing the ISIS sign. Some of these posts found a large audience. At 7 p.m. on January 21st, an internet research agency account posing as @10_GOP, a fictional right-wing American from the South, tweeted that Ms. Sarsour favored imposing Sharia law in the U.S., playing into a popular anti-Muslim conspiracy theory that Mr. Trump had helped to popularize on the campaign trail. This message took hold, racking up 1,686 replies, 8,046 retweets, and 6,256 likes. An hour later, @PrisonPlanet, an influential right-wing account, posted a tweet on the same theme. The following day, nearly simultaneously, a small army of 1,157 right-wing accounts picked up the narrative, publishing 1,659 posts on the subject, according to an analysis conducted by the online analytics firm Graphica on behalf of The Times. Vladimir Barish, Graphica's chief scientist, said the pattern of interference was strategically similar to troll activity targeting the vast anti-Putin protests of 2011 and 2012, with sock puppet accounts similarly trying to hijack the conversation, sometimes succeeding. There is some circumstantial evidence that they learned in a domestic context and then tried to replicate their success in a foreign context, Dr. Barish said. Things were changing on the ground in New York. At the Arab American Association of New York, the nonprofit immigrant advocacy organization Ms. Sarsour ran in Bay Ridge, hate mail began to pour in. Postcards, handwritten screeds on notebook paper, her photo printed out and defaced with red X's. This was an entirely new level, and it felt weird because it was coming from all over the country, said Kayla Santosuazo, and then the nonprofit's deputy secretary, who remembers bringing the mail to Ms. Sarsour in shoeboxes. Ms. Sarsour, worried that she had become a liability, stepped down from her position there that February. By the spring, the backlash against Ms. Sarsour had developed into a divisive political sideshow, one that easily drowned out the ideas behind the Women's March. It was like an avalanche, she said, like I was swimming in it every day. It was like I never got out of it. When she was invited to appear as a graduation speaker at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Public Health, the furor began weeks in advance. It caught the attention of the far-right polemicist Milo Yiannopoulos, who traveled to New York for a protest that attracted, as a Times reporter wrote, a strange mix including right-leaning Jews and Zionists, commentators like Pamela Geller, and some members of the alt-right. Mr. Yiannopoulos told the crowd, Linda Sarsour is a Sharia-loving, terrorist-embracing, Jew-hating, ticking time bomb of progressive horror. Ms. Sarsour recalls the period leading up to the graduation speech as particularly stressful as it approached. She had visions of a figure coming out of the shadows to kill her, some poor, like deranged person who was consumed by the dark corners of the internet who would be fueled by hate. Russian troll accounts were part of that clamor. Beginning more than a month before her speech, a handful of amplifier accounts managed by Russia's largest military intelligence agency, the GRU, circulated expressions of outrage at her being selected, often hashtagged Cancel Sarsour. When Mr. Yiannopoulos spoke, @10_GOP tweeted the juiciest phrases, the ticking time bomb of progressive horror line, and racked up 3,954 retweets and 5,967 likes. Her graduation speech passed without incident. Then the trolls waited, it seemed, for her to say or do something divisive, and that happened in early July when, emboldened after her CUNY appearance, she urged a Muslim audience outside Chicago to push back against unjust government policies, calling it the best form of jihad. In Islam, the word jihad can denote any virtuous struggle, but in the American political context, it is inextricable from the concept of holy war. A more pragmatic politician might have avoided using it, but Ms. Sarsour was feeling like her old self. "That's who I am in real life," she said. "I'm from Brooklyn, and I'm a Palestinian. It's my personality." To the Russian trolls, it was an opportunity. The following week, Russian accounts dramatically increased their volume of messaging about Ms. Sarsour, producing 184 posts on a single day, according to Advanced Democracy Incorporated. Once again, the audience responded. When @10_GOP tweeted, "Linda Sarsour openly calls for Muslims to wage jihad against Trump. Please look into this matter." It received 6,222 retweets and 6,549 likes. The account sustained an intense focus on her through July, producing 894 posts over the next month and continuing into the autumn, the group found. And once again, the backlash spilled out from social media. Protesters camped outside the kosher barbecue restaurant where her brother Mohammed worked as a manager, demanding that he be fired. He left the job and eventually New York. Her mother opened a package that arrived in the mail and screamed. It was a bizarre self-published book titled A Jihad Grows in Brooklyn that purported to be Ms. Sarsour's autobiography and was illustrated with family photographs. I mean, just imagine, Ms. Sarsour said, every day that you woke up, you were a monster. Then there's a photo of her with some of the other organizers of the Women's March, and the caption reads, "Progressive groups distance themselves from Ms. Sarsour." The photo shows Linda Sarsour and fellow co-chairs Tamika Mallory and Carmen Perez. The next caption, "Chasing Ghosts." And again, I'm reading from the New York Times article by Ellen Barry. The focus is the disinformation campaign waged on Linda Sarsour and the Women's March. How Russian trolls helped keep the Women's March out of lockstep. Continuing now, and by the way, this is listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. You're listening to a version of Radio Unnameable. I'm Linda Perry, sitting in for the late Bob Fass. We will be going to Linda's long-form response to this article and the time that where all of this was occurring after we finished this article. The next section is entitled Chasing Ghosts. It is maddeningly difficult to say with any certainty what effect Russian influence operations have had on the United States, because when they took hold, they piggybacked on real social divisions. Once pumped into American discourse, the Russian trace vanishes like water that has been added to a swimming pool. This creates a conundrum for disinformation specialists, many of whom say the impact of Russian interventions has been overblown. After the 2016 presidential election, blaming unwelcome outcomes on Russia became the emotional way out, said Thomas Ridd, author of Active Measures, The Secret History of Disinformation and Political Warfare. "It's playing a trick on you," said Dr. Ridd, a professor at Johns Hopkins University of Advanced International Studies. "You become a useful idiot if you ignore effective info ops, but also if you talk it up by telling a story, if you make it more powerful than it is, it's a trick." The divisions within the Women's March existed already. Internal disputes about identity and anti-Semitism had strained the group from its early days when one of its organizers, Vanessa Rumbel, who is Jewish, was pushed out after what she described as tense conversation with Ms. Perez and Ms. Mallory about the role of Jews in structural racism. Ms. Perez and Ms. Mallory have disputed that account. And discomfort with Ms. Sarsour had dampened enthusiasm among some Jewish progressives, said Rachel Timoner, the senior rabbi at Congregation Beth Elohim in Park Slope, Brooklyn. She recalled stepping up to defend Ms. Sarsour against racist and Islamophobic attacks, only to find each time that a new firestorm would arise, often resulting from something inflammatory and ultimately indefensible, Ms. Sarsour had said. As the months wore on, Rabbi Timoner said, Jews began asking themselves whether they were being excluded from progressive movements. In 2018, a new internal crisis was triggered by Miss Mallory's attendance at Savior's Day, an annual gathering of the Nation of Islam, led by Mr. Farrakhan. Ms. Mallory grew up in Harlem, where many viewed the Nation of Islam and its founder positively as crusaders against urban violence. Pressured to disavow Mr. Farrakhan, she refused, though she said she did not share his anti-Semitic views. After her son's father was murdered, she explained, it was the women of the Nation of Islam who supported me. I've always held them close to my heart for that reason, she said. After that, the fabric of the coalition tore slowly and painfully. Ms. Zarsour and Ms. Perez stuck by Ms. Mallory, and before long, progressive groups began distancing themselves from all three. Under intense pressure to step down as the leaders, Ms. Zarsour, Ms. Perez, and a third co-chair, Bob Bland, did so in 2019, a move they say was long planned. Russian accounts boosted their output around Mr. Farrakhan and the Women's March leaders that spring, posting 10 or 20 times a day, but there's no evidence that they were a primary driver of the conversation. Around this time, we largely lose our view into Russian messaging. In the summer of 2018, Twitter suspended 3,841 accounts traced to the Internet Research Agency, preserving 10 million of their tweets so they could be studied by researchers. A few months later, the platform suspended and preserved the work of 414 accounts produced by the GRU, the military agency. With that, a chorus of voices went silent, accounts that for years had helped shape American conversations about Black Lives Matter, the Mueller investigation, and NFL players kneeling during the national anthem. The record of the messaging around the Women's March breaks off there, too, frozen in time. Russia's exploitation of Ms. Zarsour as a wedge figure should be understood as part of the history of the Women's March, said Shireen Mitchell, a technology analyst who has studied Russian interference in Black online discourse. Russian campaigns, she said, were adept at seeding ideas that flowed into the mainstream discourse, after which, as she put it, they could just sit and wait. It's the priming of all that starting from the beginning, said Ms. Mitchell, the founder of Stop Online Violence Against Women. If those 1,000 tweets hit a division between the groups that matter, if they open and allow that division, it's no longer a crack. It becomes a valley. Others saw Russia's role as marginal, tinkering around the edges of a necessary American discussion. Mr. Lanceman, the former city council member, said it's a shame that Linda Sarsour damaged that movement by trying to inject into it noxious ideas that had no reason to be part of the Women's March. Unfortunately, he added, Russians seem very adept at exploiting these fissures. Rabbi Timoner sounded sad, recalling all that had happened. The wounds that opened up between progressives that year have never quite healed, she said. There's so much Jewish pain here, she said. Those Russian bots were poking at that pain. The Women's March continued under new leadership, but during the months of controversy, many women who had been galvanized by the first march drifted away. I can't remember all the negative stories. I just remember that there were so many of them, said Jennifer Taylor Skinner, a Seattle woman who, after the 2017 march, quit her job at Microsoft and founded The Electorate, a podcast geared towards progressive women. She hasn't ever recaptured that feeling of unity. Just thinking about it, I still feel a bit unmoored from any central movement, she said. There was a coalition possibly forming here that has been broken up. Next section is called An Aftershock. Again, you're listening to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. I'm reading from a New York Times article published on the front page September 18th, 2022 by Ellen Barry, How Russian Trolls Helped Keep the Women's March Out of Lockstep. I'm Linda Perry, sitting in for the late Bob Fass on this edition of Radio Unnameable, speaking about the disinformation campaign surrounding the Women's March and also how it affected Linda Sarsour, Palestinian activist, Brooklyn's own activist, who is also a host of WBAI's Wednesday morning show, What's Going On? And we will be going to a long form response to all of this from Linda right after this, after I finish reading this article, which is almost finished. So I'm now scrolling down. I read this on my computer to you because it's easier for me than print. The next section is entitled An Aftershock. Ms. Sarsour, 42 years old, was back in her old office in Bay Ridge this past spring, 5 years after the first women's march, when she learned from a reporter that the Russian government had targeted her. She is seldom invited to national platforms these days, and when she is, protests often follow. Whatever buzz there was around her as a future political candidate has quieted. She knows how she is seen as a polarizing figure. She has adjusted to this reality and sees herself more as an activist in the mold of Angela Davis. Sarsour said, "I'm never going to get a real job at a major nonprofit or corporation. That's the kind of impact that these things have on our lives." Data on Russian messaging around the Women's March first appeared late last year in an academic journal where Samantha R. Bradshaw, a disinformation expert at American University, reviewed state interference in feminist movements. She and her co-author, Amelie Henley, found a pattern of messaging by influential amplifier accounts that sought to demobilize civil society activism by pumping up intersectional critiques of feminism and attacking organizers. Movements, Dr. Bradshaw argues, are fragile structures, often unprepared to weather well-resourced state-backed sabotage campaigns, especially when combined with algorithms that promote negative content. But healthy social movements are essential to democracy, she said. We're not going to have a robust public sphere if nobody wants to organize protests. Ms. Sarsour isn't an academic, but she understood it very well. Lord have mercy, she said, glancing over Dr. Bradshaw's findings. Ms. Sarsour tried to get her head around it. All the time, the Russian government had been thinking about her. She had long had a sense of where her critics came from, the American right wing and supporters of Israel. A foreign government, that was something that had never occurred to her. To think that Russia is going to use me, it's much more dangerous and sinister, she said. What does Russia get out of leveraging my identity, you know, to undermine movements that were anti-Trump in America, I guess? She paused. It's just, wow. Understanding what Russian trolls did would not change her position. Still, it helped her understand that time in her life when she had been at the center of a storm. It wasn't just her fellow countrymen hating her. It wasn't just her allies disavowing her. That had happened, but it wasn't the whole story. She placed a call to Miss Mallory. We weren't crazy, she said. And that's an article by Ellen Barry, the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times on September 19th. Ellen Barry is the author of the article. Ellen Barry covers mental health. She served as the Times' Boston bureau chief, London-based chief international correspondent and bureau chief in Moscow and New Delhi. She was part of a team that won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. And this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York. Stay tuned for Linda Sarsour's response to this article and also to the disinformation campaign that was waged against her and the Women's March. Again, this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York. It is Radio Unnameable. I'm Linda Perry, sitting in for the late Bob Fass. We're going to go soon to Linda Sarsour in her long-form response from WBAI's morning show on Wednesday, September 21st.
You know we've got to find. listening to WBAI radio this morning on 99.5. What's going on with Linda Sarsour? Oh, my goodness gracious, folks. I have so much to share with you and kind of process with you. And so we're going to have a good show today. And I want you to kind of strap yourselves in for My Life, which seems to be like a movie. Every time I think I'm just on a nice little, you know, smooth path, something always happens. So my life stays exciting. So I'm excited to share with you what's been going on the last few days since the last time we spoke last week on Wednesday morning. It's going to be a beautiful day. You already know when I wake up, I believe every day that we wake up, that we're able to give our all, is going to be a great day. But it's going to be actually a great day with some good weather. And so enjoy it today. Find somewhere to relax. After work, find yourself a park to sit in. Get something delicious. Enjoy being outside. Tomorrow might be a little rainy, so you want to get your time outside in today. Yesterday, I had a great walk in Manhattan. I walked about 4 miles, and it was just beautiful to be outside, to see all the beauty of New York City, see all the beautiful faces, feeling like we're kind of almost back to our old selves again. Just so you know, I do believe that COVID's still out here, so you got to still be careful, but it was beautiful to see everybody outside. So before I tell you the craziness of the last few days in relation to me, and some of you may already know what I'm about to talk about, I want to hear what the newscast is today, because there's my life is not the only crazy thing that's happening in this world and in this country. So let's go to the newscast and we'll be right back after that.
Welcome to 2022 Tonks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. President Joe Biden was asked about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' threat to fly migrants to his home state of Delaware. The White House says it is working with local officials to prepare for the potential flight, which comes a week after DeSantis flew 48 migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard. House Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries slammed DeSantis and the Republican governors of Texas and Arizona, who have transported more than 10,000 migrants to Democratic cities.
They should start behaving like governors and stop behaving like human traffickers. They are putting politics over people in the most egregious way possible.
DeSantis, however, argued sanctuary cities should have to bear the brunt of what he called the Biden administration's open border policies.
Those migrants were being treated horribly by Biden. They were hungry, homeless. They had no opportunity at all. The state of Florida, it was volunteer, offered transport to sanctuary jurisdictions.
More than 2 million migrant encounters, a record, have been recorded so far this fiscal year. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin questioned what he called revenge politics amid a bipartisan attempt to block his plan to expedite fossil fuel permitting in a stopgap funding bill.
I've been around for a long time in state politics and federal politics. I've never seen stranger bedfellows than Bernie Sanders and the extreme liberal left siding up with the Republican leadership in the caucus. I've never seen this happen.
Democratic leaders and the president agreed to include the permitting package in return for his support of the Inflation Reduction Act. Former President Donald Trump's lawyers asked a federal appeals court to continue the delay of the DOJ's criminal investigation into classified documents kept at his Florida home. In a filing Tuesday, Trump's lawyers argued he had the power to assert executive privilege over documents currently in possession of the Biden administration. The Judicial Conference is calling for increased security for judges just a few months after the assassination attempt against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The federal court system's policymaking body also announced an extension of its pandemic-related policy, allowing for teleconferencing for civil and bankruptcy court proceedings. Charges were announced against 47 people accused of stealing $250 million from a federal program designed to provide meals for children in need during the pandemic. U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger said the defendants created a network of shell companies connected to the Minnesota-based nonprofit Feeding Our Future.
The scheme that began with a simple idea in March of 2020 grew to become the largest pandemic fraud in the United States.
Prosecutors say few meals were actually served and accused the defendants of purchasing luxury cars, property, and jewelry with the money. The FDA says it was poorly equipped to take effective action on the widespread baby formula outages this spring. In a new report, the agency points to outdated product tracking systems, inability to quickly address whistleblower complaints, and a lack of authority to address shortages. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
That was the newscast, folks. I mean, before I tell you why I'm here today, and I'm, like I said, today, I don't know how articulate I'm going to be because I'm still processing what I've learned in the past few days. But when I think about what we just heard on the newscast, I mean, we have migrants coming to the United States of America seeking asylum. And they are coming here, you know, probably from a treacherous trip through God knows what, to protect their families, to ensure that they give their families a better shot at life. Many of whom are fleeing persecution. Some are fleeing extreme poverty. Some come to America because they, somewhere along the line, someone believes that in America, migrants can come and fulfill some ideas, some hopes, some aspirations. And they get here, and we have governors like Governor Abbott in Texas and Governor DeSantis in Florida who think it's some kind of joke after someone who comes here full of pain and trauma to start telling people, hey, we're about to put you on a plane. We're going to send you somewhere and you're going to get a job and they're going to give you housing and get people, you know, hopes up, and they send them to different, you know, states around the country. And recently, I couldn't believe that there was an airplane full of people that went to Martha's Vineyard. And for folks who know Martha's Vineyard, I've been there many times. There's nothing going on in Martha's Vineyard. That's not a place that you send migrants. You know, the Martha's Vineyard doesn't have the services or the infrastructure to support these migrants. And in fact, when the migrants got there, the people in Martha's Vineyard didn't even know about it. They just kind of showed up. And so it's just horrific to be sitting here over the last few weeks seeing migrants who are human beings, who are people, being treated like a political football, like they're some kind of joke, like political revenge. Like it is so evil. Like I can't imagine how evil you have to be to use people's lives to do this just so that you could make a point to a rival political party. It's unacceptable. I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat. You already know how I feel about everybody. I don't defend political parties. I don't defend politicians. I just think that at some level we have to all be human. And so I'm grateful to be from a state like New York, where if folks have been to Port Authority, there have been buses that have been arriving with migrants, children, nonprofit organizations at the front lines here who have been welcoming them with care packages and making sure that they at least see a smiling face, that they are welcome to our city here in New York. So I just wanted to say that because it's really, really something that weighs on my conscience that we're doing this to human beings. This is not something that we should be, we wouldn't accept for ourselves, and we shouldn't accept that for others. So let's get to it, folks. First, I want to start by saying that I'm very grateful to WBAI because, you know, what I'm about to share with you, I wouldn't be here today without supporters and without people who knew me for my work and my track record, who understood what I stand for, what I've stood for. I've been pretty consistent in the ways in which I have showed up in movements for other marginalized groups besides my own and the ones that I come from. And so those folks really held me through a lot of anguish and anxiety and just so much trauma that I've experienced over the last few years. And so in the Monday New York Times, for folks who haven't read the story, it was the Monday New York Times. So just, you know, the day before yesterday at about above the fold. So we're talking about, I'm talking about the physical paper because I'm still old school. I like to read the physical paper. I like to hold the paper in my hand. It's the New York Times above the fold. And you turn to page A12 and it's two full spreads in the New York Times. So we're talking about a long form story. It's going to take you some time to get through it. You might even have to read it in a few sittings. And basically this article, which, you know, of course I had a heads up about because I'm in the article. And so the article is actually about me. And, you know, I've been since departure from my from the Women's March, which was about now we would say almost about 3 years ago. You know, I have been trying to just, you know, focus on the work that I do. I got back into, you know, what I do best, which is to mobilize and organize and street organize. And I've been working, as you know, on cases of police violence across the country. I've been training organizers, young people, college students, and, you know, helping to build institution and infrastructure. And, you know, I've gotten older. And so I've had, that's kind of been my focus area. I'm still outside. Many people still see me at direct actions. And of course, in light of the Roe decision, many folks, especially in New York, saw me, coordinating security protocol for some mass mobilizations, in New York. And so, you know, I've still been outside, but the New York Times reporter, Ellen Barry, who has written extensively for the New York Times, she has had a long track record of great journalism. She has served in many different roles at the New York Times. Most recently, she has been at the mental health desk, science desk at the New York Times, contacted me about almost 6 months ago and said to me in an email, you know, I'd like to meet you in person. I'd like to share something with you. And just so for folks who know me and kind of know my trajectory, anytime a media outlet says, I want to meet you and I need to show you something, my anxiety is about through the roof, because I have been through so much disinformation and so much attacks by the media, both the mainstream media and the right-wing media. And nothing makes me easy. Nothing makes me feel easy when it comes to the media. And so I did go and meet with Ellen, and Ellen basically started out by breaking some news to me that there's been some research that has been done into, you know, Russian intervention in the elections. And as they were kind of pursuing that research, they kind of stumbled upon my name, and they kind of followed that lead to see how far it would take them. And I'm going to read you a little excerpt from the New York Times article. Like I said, it's a pretty long article, so if you're going to read it, hopefully after the show today, you are going to need a little while. You're going to have to make some time, schedule the reading of this New York Times article, because it's long. So it says, more than 4,000 miles away, organizations linked to the Russian government had assigned teams to the Women's March at desks in bland offices in St. Petersburg, using models derived from advertising and public relations. Copywriters were testing out social media messages critical of the Women's March movement, adopting the personas of fictional Americans. They posed as Black women, critical of white feminism, conservative women who felt expense as message for many of the women. The detail. Among its four co-chairs was American activist whose hijab marked her over the 1800s and its military into discrediting, often fabricated activism made her a lightning rod for most ardent. 152 different Russian accounts, public archives of Twitter Russian, contained 2,642 tweets about Ms. Sarsour. And I can go on and on and on. And then the article, of course, goes into the research, and the article kind of goes into the impact that, you know, this kind of Russian disinformation campaign had, first off, you know, against the Women's March, but in particular against me. And so here we are on WBAI, and I want to make a few clarifications before I take you into kind of my response and how I was feeling and kind of what I went through during that time. Is I will never be one to beat the drums of war. And so I want to be clear that I am not one of those people that believes that we lost an entire elections because of the Russians. And I'm not here to, and I know the politics of the world, the international politics that we are in, and the ways in which the United States government perceives Russia. And I want to make sure that people understand that I am and have always been an anti-war activist. And I have been someone that has been critical of our military industrial complex. And so I'm not beating the drums of war here. So I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I'm talking about. But I will say that two things can be true at the same time. And it is true that there was no way that what I experienced around Women's March and in the 18 months after the first Women's March in 2017, because this research doesn't really go farther than those 18 months, there's no way that what I experienced was some organic, authentic hate online that then seeped into my actual real life. And so I just want people to know that the fact that the Russian government, which we know had an interest in someone like Donald Trump becoming the president of the United States, knowing that his kind of approach to foreign policy in relation to Russia would be obviously different than Democrats, they kind of succeeded in that, and they were part of the success of Donald Trump. I'm not saying they were the only excess of, the only success of Donald Trump. Obviously, the Democratic Party had their own flaws and their own messaging and the way that they did outreach. I mean, the Democratic Party spent a lot of time telling me about why Donald Trump was bad instead of telling the American people about what they were going to do for the American people. So that was part of it. And it goes back to what the Russians were kind of leveraging. Here they were testing messaging and seeing what worked, while the Democratic Party could have been doing the same, testing messaging and seeing what actually moves and inspires the American people. And so what happens after, just to give you context, because people might be thinking to themselves, well, why you? And this story doesn't make sense. And for me at the beginning, it didn't really make sense either until I had to sit down and really absorb and take myself through it. And so when the Russians were kind of during the 2016 election, and we already saw this from other reports, so this New York Times article just kind of is a continuation of what we have learned about the vulnerabilities of social media platforms. And so the Russian government was, of course, intent on Donald Trump becoming the president of the United States of America. And so they were using ads, they were posing as fictional Americans so that they could kind of shift narrative online about, you know, whether Donald Trump was good for Black people and how, you know, Hillary was such a horrible human being that nobody should vote for her. And they were doing all these different things that got us into, you know, really playing off the anxieties and fears of some of our, some of the American people. And then Donald Trump wins the election. And so then the Russians decide that now that the guy we wanted won the election, now we have to protect the presidency. And so they saw the emergence of a pretty powerful, well-organized, coordinated and funded anti-Trump kind of coalition or movement. And so they set their eyes on the Women's March. And of course, you know, I can understand that. Women's March organized the largest single day protest in U.S. history. Until today, no one has been able to organize a larger single day protest than the Women's March on Washington. And that's just facts of the matter. And so the Russians, and I mean, when I say the Russians, I mean the Russian government, because I always like to make a distinction between a people of a nation and then their governments, because that's very important for us to do. So the Russian government basically started studying American racism, I believe, and started looking at the Women's March and saying, what can we do here? And as you saw from the excerpt that I shared with you, and then you will read more about this and actually read more specific messaging that the Russian government attempted to use. It's so surreal, folks, when I think about it. Because what the Russians did is not that the Russians created things. They scoured the internet to see if they could find messaging that they can amplify to see how far they can take or how far people would take. Because remember, when you have a well-coordinated and well-funded disinformation campaign, you keep repeating things through multiple accounts to make it look like it's a trending topic, which then invites others. That's what happens with trending topics. When you go on social media, on Twitter, if you're on, you know, you're on TikTok, you're on Instagram, and there's a particular conversation that's happening or a particular trend, people tend to join the trend, right? Even if they weren't part of it originally, they tend to join it. So what the Russian government was doing is they were looking at messaging. So the first messaging, which is, this is so crazy because we really believed that this conversation was so high level. So as many folks know, initially the Women's March, the original group of white women that kind of had the idea in the first maybe couple of days before the women of color joined, they had called it the Million Women's March. Now we as women of color immediately picked up on that And we were like, yeah, no, that's not going to be the name of the march, because we knew, because as students of history and because of the work that we've done and the relationships that we have, that in 1997, there was already a Million Women's March that was led and organized by Black women in Pennsylvania. And in fact, 2017 would have been the 20th anniversary of that Million Women's March. And so we told the white women that there's no way that we're going to let you call this the Million Women's March. First of all, we didn't get permission from the original woman, at just out of courtesy and respect. And also, it wouldn't be fair to do that. And for us, we felt like this particular march needed its own kind of name. But we also believed that there was this swift conversation and trend that was happening online where people were telling us, change the name, although we were already in the process of doing that. I read the New York Times article, and apparently that was a conversation that was amplified through this disinformation campaign by this Russian operation. And so again, finding messaging that already exists, the Russians didn't create the messaging. They just tested what they had already seen online. And so, of course, they went from one message to the next. It wasn't really moving on the internet. It didn't stop the Women's March. This was prior to the actual date of the Women's March, which was January 21st of 2017. And so then we get to the Women's March, and 4 million women in the United States, of course, and our allies got up on that day on January 21st, and they rose up across the country from 1.2 million in Washington, D.C., to 750,000 in New York, to similar numbers in places like Chicago and Houston and Los Angeles. I mean, we were in every major city in America, including small towns in all 50 states. And it was an absolutely incredible day. And it will always be one of the highlights of my activism career. And I was and continue to be honored to have been one of the national co-chairs of the Women's March and to be one of the co-founders of the Women's March. And to make sure that I reaffirm here, because a lot of times women are told that we are not to kind of laud our own accomplishments, that Women's March on Washington that so many people continue to remember till today and remember how they felt and watched generations of women show up together with those that they love, and the feeling people had of solidarity and unity was really created and curated by seasoned organizers who knew that we were more than just an anti-Trump movement, that we were a movement of women who had principles and values that we wanted to make sure seeped into every part of our society. And I believe wholeheartedly that we succeeded. And so the Women's March goes on without a hitch. And then the Russian government, and of course, just to be clear, the haters already existed, and my haters specifically were on the internet before there was ever any involvement of the Russian government. I have been vehemently critiqued and criticized for at least a decade prior to the Women's March. And you could all imagine why. I'm Palestinian. I am a vehement critic of the state of Israel for their continued brutal military occupation of my beloved Palestinian people. I was critiqued for my work as, at the time, a police reform activist and kind of going up against, the New York Police Department in particular. But of course, as time kind of went by, my views around policing got a bit more defined. And I consider myself to be now an abolitionist and believing that the world and the country we live in must define safety in different ways, that police are not the answer to every social ill that we have in society. And so, so I had already been critiqued and vehemently targeted, and more so in like headlines, some Twitter. Every once in a while, I'd go to a press conference and I would say something. I would go to a city council hearing and spar with conservative city council members. And so I wasn't, just to be clear, I wasn't immune or shocked by people, you know, opposing who I am. Of course, I'm a Muslim, a woman. I wear hijab, so I'm observant Muslim. So you can, you know, I'm Muslim when you see me. So again, I wasn't like super shocked that people had some sort of oppositional views to my participation in the Women's March. You know, and some white feminists were kind of like, okay, we haven't seen this one before. You know, I'm a Muslim woman in hijab, a woman of faith, and very unapologetic about that. But I also have values that around safety and dignity for all people. And my track record was very clear and aligned with that. So then the Russian government and their military service and their KGB and I don't know who else. I mean, I'm learning a lot about Russia just through this, decided to test messaging they found online about me. And so things like, you know, Islamophobic tropes, they amplified, you know, anti-Muslim sentiments, of course, that exist in our country. Anti-Palestinian sentiment, anti-Semitism, my positions on boycott, divestment, sanctions, you know, saying things that I was, nefarious, that my agenda was to like infiltrate the, you know, feminist movement and making it sound really dark and scary. And guess what? The messaging went like wildfire. The internet lit up when they decided to test messaging about me in relation to the Women's March. So basically they decided that let's try this and see what happens. So if we can't get to the Women's March directly, we're going to go after this woman. And they did. And it was swift and it was fast and it was trending on the internet within a matter of hours, about maybe a day after the Women's March. And I remember waking up to it and thinking to myself, this is crazy. This can't be organic or authentic. Like, it can't be that the internet overnight just thousands and thousands and maybe millions of people, all of our country hate me that much. I mean, these people don't know me. Like, how is this possible? And so that was the first time that it happened. And it was something that was in my heart that told me that, yeah, of course you got haters. There are people out there that don't like you, but this is on just a whole other level. And so I'm going to just let you sit with that for a minute as you reflect on this, the tumultuous times we had at the Women's March and the many times you saw us in headlines and me in headlines, and just want you to sit with that for a minute. I'm going to take a break because I want to sit with it again for a minute. And then I'm going to come back and just kind of tell you kind of what transpired after that. And then I'm going to take you into, you know, why this is a cautionary tale and why and how we're going to move forward together. So we're going to take a quick break and then you and I are going to come back to this conversation. You were listening to Marcel Khalife. So it is 7:32 a.m. on a beautiful Wednesday morning. I'm just looking out the window. It's a beautiful day, folks, so make the best of it. And I have had to make the best of many days, and sometimes really have to force myself to make the best of days, because the days that I was going through were quite dark. And so we were just discussing this again, front page Monday of the New York Times, above the fold, and then two full spreads on page, starting on page 812. And I'm just, you know, still really absorbing that New York Times article. I actually read it about three times. And the first time I read it, it took me two sittings to like kind of go back to it. And there were parts that I had to read over, because I'm like, what is going on here? And I was before we went to break, I was kind of talking about, you know, how we kind of got here. You know, the Russian operation, this disinformation campaign that was testing messaging. Some messaging just wasn't moving on the internets. And then finally, when they got to me and decided that I was going to be the target based on things they had already seen online, and decided this was the messaging that they were going to go with. And all of a sudden, the kind of Islamophobic, anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian tropes that they decided to amplify, and of course, negative comments about me and misinterpretation of things that I had said years ago, all went flying on the internet. It was everywhere. It went like wildfire. And I think that, you know, it really raised for them, like, whoa, this is good right here. We're gonna go with this. And so they, at least based on this research, you know, we can definitely confirm that it was at least for 18 months. And in those 18 months from January of 2017 into 2018, I saw and experienced things that I hope no one ever has to experience. And really, regardless of what side of the political aisle you are on, whether you are someone that agrees with me or doesn't agree with me, or you sometimes agree with me, this should be unacceptable at every level, because what this disinformation campaign, which of course was already sparked by bad faith actors, you know, the pro-Israel lobby, right wing, the MAGA folks, you know, conservative Republicans, you know, of course, MAGA meaning the Donald Trump supporters. And then, of course, because of the massive dissemination and disinformation campaign, then it kind of started seeping into kind of Democratic spaces, and even amongst people that I'd realized, thank God this happened, realized were not actually progressive. They were just kind of acting progressive on some issues, but turns out overall they weren't really that progressive. So it did expose a lot of people. And so again, this messaging worked, they went with it. And what it did was it began to create so much chaos around the Women's March and around my leadership in particular. And it was so often and so much that by the time we get to even 2018, when many of you know we got into a very large controversy at Women's March, we really had no grace or benefit of the doubt left. It was constant targeting, constant on the defense, constant statements. Yes, we said that. No, we didn't say that. It's not what we meant. All kinds of things were happening. And it really sent a lot of, you know, bad vibes into the larger constituency that we had over time. And I hope the folks and the many women who supported Women's March that were starting to be like, whoa, what's going on here? I hope you now realize what happened and that how vulnerable our movements are to discord and disunity. You know, we must have had enough gaps there that were then filled by outside actors, both domestic and foreign. And so if many folks remember back in May of 2017, this also hit the New York Times. I was invited to be the commencement speaker at the CUNY Graduate School for Public Health, the School of Public Health. And it was going to be at the Apollo Theater, and it was going to be, you know, a small graduating class. Majority of the folks at the School for Public Health are New Yorkers. They are, you know, people of color. They are people who often have full-time jobs, who are trying to get their grad degree. And the student population that was graduating and some of the faculty at the time wanted me to be the commencement speaker. They specifically wanted me to be it. And the minute I was announced, like it wasn't even like an hour later, the internet went wild. And there was a hashtag at the time, cancel Sarsour. And it caught the attention of some of the worst of the worst. I'm talking about, and I don't even like to mention these names online, but I'm going to have to make a point. Milo Yiannopoulos, who was a darling, who was a darling of the right, of the alt-right, one of the leaders of the alt-right, had a big persona online at that time. He was really shaping a lot of conversation. Pamela Geller, many of you know her. She's a notorious Islamophobe. She was the one that put up those crazy, like, anti-Muslim bus ads and was one of the biggest vehement, like, protesters around the what she called the Ground Zero Mosque. Gavin McGinnis, who was Proud Boys, or I can't even tell the white men apart these days, but, you know, Gavin McGinnis, there was a Robert Spencer, I mean, a former Assemblyman Dov Hyken, who, if New Yorkers know, is absolutely outrageous. I mean, the lineup was just, I couldn't believe how bad the lineup was. And they organized a actual rally outside the CUNY administrative offices to the point where the CUNY administrative offices shut down for the day just to keep their staff safe. And this protest happens, and apparently violence erupts at it. Apparently people that I, you know, that came out to support, and they were counter protesters. I mean, it was a lot. And the controversy around that CUNY speech in particular started weeks before I even gave the speech, to the point where I actually fled the country. I mean, I actually left and went to Mexico. And I'm just grateful for the people. There were a group of young people in my community who did one of those online fundraising campaigns and raised about $3,900 that I then used literally to flee the country, because it was that bad. I mean, people were, the phone calls, the messages, the emails, the showing up to places that I was. I mean, it was a lot to handle. So I just literally fled the country. And all this was happening. And then, you know, cancel Sarsour is trending on Twitter sometimes for days at a time. And I was like, this can't be real. Like, this can't be organic. This, there can't be that many people who care that I'm going to do an unpaid. So just to be clear, I wasn't getting any taxpayer dollars. CUNY wasn't paying me to be the commencement speaker, that people would be this mad. And so I ended up doing this CUNY speech anyway, because the people at CUNY stood their ground and they said, students want you. We know who you are. You are a New Yorker. You're part of the CUNY system. You are coming and you are speaking. And I did. And it was incredible and inspiring. I had one of the longest standing ovations that I've ever experienced. And it was beautiful. And I did it. And it was Ramadan and I was fasting and it was a lot going on. And it happened. It was great. The point of the story is that even that moment, that controversy that was created around me, I really thought that it was the right wing, that they knew how to trend stuff and do stuff. Turns out they needed the Russians to help them elevate their campaign to demand my cancellation at CUNY. So again, this article is just so telling for me about the many times, and it's so connected to all the moments that I was in controversy. Like every time there was a controversy, this kind of disinformation operation kind of found themselves in that. And when you read the article, you learn some things. You know, remember, I have parents, older parents who live in Brooklyn who still have a landline, who were getting messages, voicemails all the time. I mean, my parents had to hear these voicemails in between voicemails that they were probably getting from their doctors and other folks and my sisters and other people. So they often listened to them, and they were horrific. You know, imagine parents having to hear what somebody wants to violently do to their child. I mean, that's the kind of messages my parents had to hear. And then receiving mail to my parents' house, receiving mail at my offices that were absolutely horrific. I mean, we had shoeboxes of them. That's how much, and I was getting them from every corner of this country. And then, of course, you know, showing up to events across the country in Arizona, in North Carolina, Florida, and just places, especially in open carry states, where I would literally be met with protesters outside that were carrying guns that were bigger than me. And so just the experience, the compromising of my safety, the compromising of the safety of my family and my children. And that's what the problem happens. You know, what I want, and that's kind of what you'll get out of this New York Times article. Of course, you know, I wrote a little bit about it in my book, in my memoir called We Are Not Here to Be Bystanders. And in fact, the title of my book came from my speech at CUNY after all that I've been through, and my call to action for the people, the graduates and their families and the faculty and all the folks was, we are not here to be bystanders, and that I was not going to be silenced nor intimidated, that I had a mission and a vision and a purpose that I was going to fulfill. And so, you know, the past few years of my life, just being, you know, constantly attacked and targeted and policed for my tone and for my words, and it was all in bad faith, and that's what I originally thought. It was just people of bad faith that were doing that. Now I know that they were amplified by this unfortunate foreign disinformation campaign. And so where do I want to go from here? So I already went through it. You know, there's nothing that anybody can do to give me back my safety, to give me back the anguish, the anxiety that I felt, the resources that I spent on security. Many people, that know me, especially folks, and many WBAI listeners who were outside with me at many direct actions and protests, you know, used to see me. With security detail. That was security detail oftentimes that I paid out of my own pocket for. And so those resources I'm not getting back. The time that I spent responding and trying to defend myself against allegations and accusations, I'm not getting that time back either. And in some regards, in some spaces, you know, parts of my reputation, I may never get that back either, but I'm grateful that I'm the kind of person that, you know, I know who I am, and I'm grateful for the folks that always saw through it all. But it's really a cautionary tale, and it's a cautionary tale for progressives, for our left movements. There's a lot of discord. There's a lot of disagreements that we have. And I always say to people, we got to be able to tell the difference, to distinguish between the disagreements, the debates, because we should have them. And people, and I welcome people to debate my ideas and welcome people to ask me questions and understand why I believe the things that I believe. Why do I fight for the things that I fight for? And sometimes even when I explain it to you, you might still disagree with me. But there has to be ways that we get to disagree without calls for violence, without, slander and defamation, you know, regarding people that you're debating with as actual, we should be able to look at each other and say, hey, you know, I don't agree with this lady on a lot of things, but you know what? She's a mom from Brooklyn. She's a human being. Like, I'm not going to sit here and spend time on the internet slandering her when I could just be debating her ideas. And so again, you know, it's a cautionary tale about how vulnerable our movements are. And sometimes when we see conversations about our colleagues or about institutions, about organizations, about segments of our movements, we got to be a little more vigilant about asking questions and then thinking to ourselves, you know, how could this be? How did this conversation get here? You know, can we pick up the phone, which by the way, people don't do anymore, and ask questions and make sure that we are not playing into something that is sinister and nefarious. And in fact, if we have an issue with a colleague in our movement, that we should be able to have those courageous conversations. And so I want you to sit with that. And, you know, I just told you a lot of things about just, you know, experience, of course, of only one woman of color, of one activist and organizer. But I want you to sit that there are women across the country who are on the front lines in local cities who are being targeted by local law enforcement. They're being, you know, targeted by right-wing factions in their own communities, women who oftentimes are moving from location to location because they don't feel safe. People in our movements who have been doxxed, as I have, meaning that people would post our personal information, specifically our addresses, where we live on the internets. You know, this has happened to many people, not just to me. And again, you know, this New York Times article happens to be about me, but when I read it, and I hope that for many of you who do read it, and if you've ever experienced, you know, online harassment or even harassment in real life, that, you know, that you're not triggered by it. I just wanted, you know, to make sure that you know what you're getting yourself into. So I'm gonna let you sit with all this until I come back from a break to kind of close this out and kind of close out my own thoughts about this, because this is actually WBAI. This show is the first time since that New York Times article that I've been able to kind of talk about this in long form And so we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be right back.
And I was the youngest person to do so. I was determined to let Wallace see what he had done to me.
Posters on the roadside accusing Dr. Luther King of being communist trained. Another propaganda too, this time from the air. Light planes are dropping leaflets calling on white employers to sack their Negro workers.
Jubilation. When we're at the Capitol and Wallace is up in the window peeping behind the blinds and he didn't come out to see my bandage over my head that covered the 7 stitches.
We had marched that 50 miles that they told us that we weren't going to march.
They had to surrender the steps of the Capitol. It's a very triumphant moment.
They told us we wouldn't get here. Now with those said that we would get here only over that dead body.
Well,
all the world today knows that we are here and we are standing before the forces of power in the state of Alabama saying we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
I was a doctor. Nothing did for us what that did.
Keep on walking, keep on talking. Marching on a freedom land.
You all know it, but it's one of my favorite movement songs, and I sing it all the time when I'm outside where we're protesting and doing civil disobedience. You've probably heard me sing it before, you know, and I wanted you to listen to a little bit of that song because it kind of takes me to my final thoughts for around this. And, you know, I want to move forward from it, but I think there's an opportunity for us to learn from it. I want to put myself in some historical context. You know, while this particular example in the New York Times, that again, I hope you all read and share, and I'd love for you to share your thoughts online about it, because it's important that we have this discussion, that it's not just the one, you know, one blitz article and then we kind of move from it, because it's important to how we move forward. We are in dangerous times. We are in chaotic times for our people, for marginalized people, the destabilization of nations across the world, you know, the climate change, you know, we're watching what's happening to our sisters and brothers and family in Puerto Rico. A third of Pakistan is underwater and people, millions displaced. You know, we're watching our, you know, family in Jackson, Mississippi, and of course, in many other cities across the country who do not have access to clean water, the voter suppression. And it's just, we can go on and on. And of course, the continuation of the impacts of the COVID pandemic and of course, new emerging pandemics that are impacting our people. And so we are in, you know, very, very, you know, uncertain times also. And so this is not new. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm sharing some story with you, like some bombshell that I can't believe this happened to me. I can believe it happened to me because it's happened before. And we know that our own government, the United States government, is capable of the same, of surveillance, of sowing discord, as we saw in the civil rights movement. We have seen the defamation and slander and discreditation of leaders throughout, you know, history, not just in the civil rights movement, but specifically in this country. We watched what was done to people who dared speak truth to power, dared to mobilize and organize people towards justice and equity. People like Dr. King, who really, you know, started bringing people together of all backgrounds and saying we could all stand together and fight for one another, that there shouldn't be oppression Olympics, that we could actually come together and we can fight for equity together as Black and brown and poor people in America. And that's when our FBI and our government set their eyes on someone like Dr. King, when they saw that he was able to resonate with people outside of his own community. And so I know this, and that this has happened historically, which is why I'm not moved, and which is why I'm still here, which is why I'm willing to continue to struggle and continue to risk, and know that I will continue to be policed, both for my words and for, of course, for my actions. And that's why I'm going to keep doing this work. And I hope that for all of you, what you get out of this experience that I had over the years, and also, you know, coming to this New York Times article, is that sometimes in order for us to speak truth to power, we have to understand that there comes consequences. And I have experienced many of those consequences, but I also have to understand that it's going to be worth it, and that I may not get my flowers in this lifetime, but I hope that at least based on the work that I've done, the seeds that I planted a generation after me or two or three will benefit from the fruits of my labor and the labor of the many that are on the front lines in this country right now. And that I am going to continue to speak up for Palestine, and that I'm going to be and continue to be unapologetically Palestinian American, and I'm going to be unapologetically Muslim American. Because for me and many activists and organizers, our people count on us to be unapologetic about ourselves. And when we are unapologetic, and when we are brave and we are courageous, that means our people are going to be courageous and brave. And so for me, yes, I've experienced all these bad things over time. There were moments where I didn't know if I was going to live to the next week. But I did know that, and I was content with the choices that I had made. And I want to say to all of you, as we move forward in this movement, as we continue to fight for voting rights, for women's rights, for immigrants and refugees, and for Black folks, and for people with disabilities and other marginalized people, that we have to keep in mind that our leaders are flawed, and that there are no perfect leaders. And I in no way am a perfect leader, and I'm a human being, and I will make mistakes, and many of our people will make mistakes. And what we ask of you as you see us do this work is grace and benefit of the doubt, and an opportunity for debate and conversation. So again, you were listening today to Linda Sarsour on WBAI. I love you, WBAI, and all of our listeners. I wouldn't be here today without your support, and you also seeing through all that I've experienced and then giving me this platform, because people like me don't get platforms in the same way as others do. And I'm grateful to have this platform. So if you haven't yet supported WBAI, we need you, because without you, there would be no WBAI and there would be no me, and you wouldn't get to hear from all the incredible people and organizers that I bring to you to WBAI and have the really important, courageous conversations that no one else on other media outlets want to have. And so again, I love you, WBAI. I love you to all the listeners who come every Wednesday morning to see what I have to say and what my friends have to say. Till next week, I'll see you, or maybe you'll hear me next Wednesday.
Blessing in disguise. Do unto others as you would have done unto you. Listen, that's just a word from the wise. Live for the faith, but we doubt in the truth. Cause the proof only show that you care about you, about us. If you really do, give us a sign. We got women and children at the borderline. Jimmy Cliff told me there's many rivers. The cross came to help him recover the cause.
They said that Jesus Christ went to Egypt. colorist to Ethiopia for refuge. People running here and there looking for a home. Refugees seeking to be free. Refugees looking for safety.
I'm so glad that you're still with us, broken not sure who. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price.
Don't punish me with brutality.
And you've been listening to Radio Unnameable over WBAI in New York. You heard a reading from the New York Times, a piece by Ellen Berry, how Russian trolls helped keep the Women's March out of lockstep as American feminists came together in 2017 to protest Donald Trump. Russia's disinformation machine set about deepening the divide among them. And the article focused on Linda Sarsour, Palestinian activist, Brooklyn mom, host of WBAI's What's Going On on Wednesday mornings, Linda Sarsour. And she delivered a long-form talk on WBAI all about the peace and what she experienced and what she's going through right now, and gave us hope for the movement, for the future. And then you heard a medley of songs, Thank You, Sly and the Family Stone, followed by Trump Is on Your Side, Moby and the Heartland Choir, Refugees, Jimmy Cliff, and then you heard Lizzo with Special, followed by The Chicks, Not Ready to Make Noise, Buffy St. Marie, You've Got to Run, and then finally, What's Going On, Marvin Gaye, which is the theme song for the morning show on WBAI, 7 to 8 a.m., What's Going On. I'm Linda Perry, sitting in here for the late Bob Fass here on Radio Unnameable on listener-sponsored WBAI New York. Thank you so much for listening.